Blog Talk Radio.
We're a nation of haters under their control. To rise up everybody and burn down, burn down the system. Pay up the exit poll. Wake up the silence.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show, episode number 49. And this is one of your co-hosts, Stephen Zimmer, and we have with us tonight Alexander Brown co-hosting with us. How are you doing tonight, Alex?
Hey, doing good. What about yourself?
Oh, that was on the razor. We're having trouble logging into our dashboard tonight, and we had him literally with seconds left. So that was a bit of a tight squeeze there to get in here. So I know that you and I both skated in right on the edge here, but they were having some technical issues getting into the show tonight.
Yeah, we got in by the skin of our teeth, literally.
Yes, but that's how things go in the broadcast media world sometimes. So, we've. We've had some good shows recently, but we got a gem of one tonight, and I think that tonight's definitely the perfect guest for you to be on tonight, Alex, because we definitely have a horror guru with us joining us in just a few minutes, who we will announce. But first of all, catch up just a little bit. It's been a little while since I've actually talked to you because I've been kind of swamped with stuff. What's been going on with you lately?
Just work, working on new stories, and. I've been networking a lot on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I've had quite a few people contact me saying, hey, we bought your books off of Amazon, so there's a few Southern Haunts that's been purchased, as well as Traumatized and Cerinthia Falls, so this has been a pretty good week for networking. And also coming up, I do have a convention that I'm going to on June 19th through 21st, and that's going to be BayouCon in Sulphur, Louisiana.
Very cool. Yeah, well, as everybody can say who's seen you at a convention, you are a blast to be around at a convention, that's for sure.
Well, thank you, especially if I have some crown with me, but that's a different story.
Well, a whole bunch of us are going to be elsewhere that weekend. As far as like some of the SSP crew and our other friends in the writing world, we're going to, that same weekend, 19th, 21st, so I think, we're going to be down in, we're going to be out in Nashville. And there we go.
And
we
that's Hypericon, correct?
Yep, that's Hypericon. And that's going to be, it's going to be the launch party for Born of Swords. That's a new Garias Lagal novel, Stephen Shrewsbury. I know Peter Welmerink, Brick Marlin. I just heard Jen Mulvihill is going to be there, J.L. Mulvihill. Yeah, we got quite a crew. Jackie Gamber is going to be there. We got a bunch of folks coming to that one. So it's going to be a lot of fun in Nashville. It's actually one of my must-go conventions every year, so I'm pretty excited about that one. So, yeah, it'll be a good cluster of us gathering in Nashville that weekend. It'll be fun. And the week before that, actually, we have a little bit of an event going on in Cincinnati at Joseph Beth, Selah Janelle, and Michael West, both who are co-hosts of this show, are going to be joining me up in Cincy there, and we're going to be doing a panel on speculative fiction. signing giveaways, and we're going to have a cool after-event party at the Bronte Bistro, and all that gets underway at 7 o'clock at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Cincy, and that's June 13th. So quite a bit of stuff kind of looming here, so that's kind of exciting. And then on the publishing front, we had a brand new release recently, actually from both releases, I should say, from both Chris Garrison, E. Chris Garrison with Blue Spirit, and then also with John Allen with an ebook release of Codename Night Ranger, which comes from his Ivory Black universe, the same universe that the novel The God Killers came from. And then just around the corner, of course, I already mentioned we have Born of Swords from great Robert E. Howard-style Sword and Sorcery from Stephen Shrewsbury. And then we also have a great short story collection coming out called Darkness with a Chance of Whimsy, and that is from R.J. Sullivan. So, we've been definitely working quite a bit and quite a bit of stuff. Yeah, it's a busy time, Alex. What can I say?
Busy year. Very busy.
Oh, I know.
And a prosperous one, too.
Yeah, I hope so. The one fun thing I'm doing is I'm resurrecting my 1992 Z28, so I am having a little fun nowadays. So I'm getting that up to speed, and I get a new, brand new metallic silver paint job. So I'm having a little bit of fun, too, so it's not all serious. I didn't want anybody to think I was being serious all the time. But I'm having a little fun with that. But before we bring our guest on, I'd like to say a few words about him, of course. And this is actually one of our favorite guests that we had in 2014. And he also, I could go on and on about him. He's a scholar. He's a severe movie expert. He's also a great, great writer. And his novels include like Burning the Middle Ground and Descending Lines, and he's also had 2014 released anthology Leaping at Thorns, and he's got all kinds of projects going on. And the guy's amazing, just a genius, and a truly delight to be around. And I know that you enjoyed him as well last time. And so we'd like to welcome back into the Star Chamber, L. Andrew Cooper. You are live, and it's great to have you back with us.
Thank you, Stephen. Unfortunately, that amazing person you just described couldn't make it, but I'm going to talk instead. But thank you. I'm a different L. Andrew Cooper, and I'm going to talk with you instead. And I happen to know a lot about the books you just mentioned, as well as the projects you just mentioned. So, minus the coolness. Hi, it's nice to talk with you tonight.
Wonderful. Well, we've got a doppelganger with us tonight. Well, at least you sound like him too. So that's good news.
It'd be cool to be the thing. To be like in touch with the massive consciousness and at least the John Carpenter versions. Why not? Hey.
Yeah. So how have you been doing? I've been in this whirlwind of activity lately, so I haven't even gotten the chance to catch up with you too much. So let's give you a chance to just say what you've been, what's the latest with you as far as recently?
It's been pretty whirlwindy on my side as well. The most exciting thing recently is just a few weeks ago at the World Horror Convention with the Bram Stoker Awards, we debuted a new edited collection that I co-edited with Pamela Turner, who I think is also a friend of the show. We released a book called Real Dark, which is a collection of dark fiction on the theme of how movies infect real life. And so there's definitely a horror tone to the collection, but we've got everything from westerns to comedies to even sort of bizarre relationship. I don't know if you want to call it romance, but it gets close anyway. To of course my story is just straight up horror, it's got authors from J.G. Faherty to James Doerr to the scariest story in the book, by my opinion. No offense to any of the other contributors who wrote great great stories, but the scariest is by Amy Grech. So, you know, definitely Hal Bodner's our featured story writer. We also have some great poetry. It's just an amazing collection of work with this movie theme, and so it sort of draws together all of my passions and, again, just an amazing list of authors. So that was an exciting debut and just an amazing project to get off the ground. I can't believe the number of times I just said amazing, but there you go.
Well, it is amazing, and I'll add a couple more amazings, because I definitely, I mean, you mentioned Pamela Turner, and I think she is just an amazing talent, to use the word one more time. And I remember when we were talking together in Louisville at the, I believe it was at Fandom Fest, Pamela, myself, and you were, everything was kind of, was developing at that time, and we got a chance to talk about the upcoming book at that time, and I was definitely excited because of the fact that the team of you and she together, I mean, because she is just such a gifted writer, and as a panelist, she's awesome. She's got like a wealth of knowledge about a lot of literary areas, and so I thought it was a great combination of with the two backgrounds that you have coming together to serves editors on the project. So how did it all come about as far as working with Pamela?
I mean, it was definitely a team effort. I mean, the concept for the book was one that I approached the publisher of Blackworm with, and I approached Pamela with, and when I invited her to edit with me. But once we were reviewing submissions, it was definitely a team effort. And of course, the vision of the book evolved once we looked at the submissions. And it was amazing, first of all, how much our list of top stories, top rated stories in the different categories we set up in advance overlapped with other reviewers as well, but also when we disagreed, we managed to talk to each other and convince each other, where she changed my mind on some things and I changed hers on some things, because she's like very insightful and very gifted at expressing her point of view, and so I think she has, she's due a lot of credit for the way that the vision evolved through the project and for the high quality of the book at the end. It was definitely a team effort.
Yeah, no, Alex, you should jump in here, because, I mean, you are no stranger to collaborating as an editor on anthology releases. So I know you probably have a few things you may want to talk to Andrew about.
Oh, yeah, and I just wanted to make a few comments. I don't know if I'm the only one who's experienced this, but when putting together an anthology, I've learned something different with each and every single book. And it's not only been just timing and structure and communications, it's just been from point A, it coming together, to point B, landing on your desk, Stephen, and it's just, I've learned something new every year, and when I first got into doing anthologies, I'm like, oh, yay, fun and anthology, this is going to be awesome, and then it's like all the work that goes into it, once you create an anthology and edit it, that is some work. After I finished Southern Haunts 1, I'm like, wow, any dude who can do an anthology, my hat is off to him or her. So I feel like being an editor to anthologies, we're like veterans of just pulling out our hair at 1 a.m. and drinking coffee nonstop.
Or more than coffee.
Spiked coffee. There we go.
Yeah, publishing has driven me to consume more bourbon. I will admit it.
It's definitely a different kind of work, and it's also different. I mean, not all editors are also writers, but to sort of take off the writer hat long enough to be a serious editor and realize that, of course, you can only accept a minority of submissions, and sometimes you say no to work you think is brilliant because it just doesn't fit.
Exactly.
That's a painful thing to do as someone who also thinks of himself as an artist. It's like, wait, this is brilliant art, but I'm going to say no to it. That's a horrible thing to have to do, but it's also something that's, you know, if you can understand it the right way, encouraging to writers. It's like, hey, the rejections aren't necessarily meaning anything about the quality of your writing. It just has to do with the agenda of the project that you've tried to submit to. But it's still
exactly.
it's hard to switch gears from writer mode to the enemy.
Well, you know, Mr. Cooper, let me ask you this. When I finish editing an anthology and then I jump onto my own work, I feel like my mind is even more enriched because I'm just stepping from one position to the next, and I feel that the rough draft is a lot easier for me to create after going through that whole editorial process, because once you go through that process, your eyes just kind of capture the mistakes as you're writing it. It's almost kind of like in photography, for example, if you specialize in black and white photography, sometimes you can see the world in black and white before you take that picture. Have you had that experience with jumping from an editor's seat into the author's seat?
I have. I mean, you know, fiction editing, you know, I've also been spent a lot of my life as a teacher, and so I've read literally thousands of student papers, much more, composition, expositional writing than creative writing. So I've got a lot of experience, you know, thinking about issues of voice in addition to grammar and so on, and that capacity of editing. I've also taught technical editing and been a professional consultant on technical editing. So I've got a lot of different perspectives on editing that some of which I really need to shut down when I'm trying to be creative. And then others of which definitely sort of inform both my drafting process and then definitely my editing process. I've never had a book-length manuscript that didn't lose 100 pages between first draft and a submittable draft. And that's cutting off a limb. But it's necessary surgery, usually. It's not quite a river runs through it half as long, but there is some brutality necessary, some masochism that must be experienced.
Definitely, definitely agreed. I want to touch on your book, Gothic Realities. There's a part.
Take me back to the beginning. All right.
Yeah, I want to go back there, and then we'll just kind of go forward from there. But the reason why I want to bring this up is because out of all of your books, there's something that's really struck me with Gothic Realities. And the theme is something that we're seeing a lot more of today, not only in horror literature or movies, but one of the topics of Gothic Realities says, in a sense, they were right. The Gothic played formative roles in the scientific creations of homo and heterosexuality in the 19th century, and it provided the means for articulating and even perceiving real ghosts. So can we get a little bit more in depth to that right there?
Basically, I mean, the argument in that book is I'm trying to do two things in that book. I'm trying to acknowledge that historically, Gothic fiction, which I don't really distinguish from horror fiction. I think there's a historical continuum, and if you try to draw a line somewhere on it, you're always going to fail. Historically, the fiction has been so powerful that it has provided the means to articulate and to perceive phenomena in the way that perhaps the majority of people articulate and perceive those phenomena today. And that's a true thing. And so the examples you just mentioned, the people, the way that the majority of people historically have, and a decreasing majority, but still a majority of people perceive homosexuality and heterosexuality in relation to homosexuality, historically came from ideas that were articulated in Gothic fiction. And I'm not the only person who's ever claimed this. A lot of people have talked about this in scholarship, but that's an argument I bring in relation to an argument about how ideas and terms in fiction about ghosts helped people to understand and articulate experiences that they reported with quote-unquote real ghosts. Now, of course, the thing about ghosts is that there isn't a majority consensus about their existence. And so there's a real distinction on the sort of existential or ontological level where ghosts are concerned. And so that's one of the major distinctions I'm making and when I'm taking those two different subjects and talking about how fiction relates to reality. In that project. But either way, what they have in common is this basic idea that a lot of the language we use to understand these phenomena as real comes from fiction first.
Very, very interesting. And thank you for answering that. That was something that I was like, wow, that's a topic you don't see too much of in discussions, and so thank you for giving us that opportunity. With your next book, Monsters, it focuses on texts such as Dracula, Frankenstein. It focuses on some of the classics and also some of the contemporary horror films, and it also shows that it is designed as a textbook for first-year college writing classes, so this could be really great for any first-year writers in college. Out of the classics, compared to what we have now, and when I say contemporary, let's just maybe go with the last year, have we lost the classic form of horror that we had with things, with subjects such as Frankenstein, Dracula, and even subjects that came into play in the 80s and 90s, such as Freddy Krueger, Jason, Candyman, so on and so forth. What in the last year do you think is going to be the next iconic figure?
Well, they don't come around every year, so it's only giving me a year to play with isn't very fair.
All right, well, I'll tell you what, how about 5 years? Can we work with that?
I mean, it's not a recent phenomenon, and it's one that I'm starting to find increasingly nauseating. But, I mean, right now we're sort of stuck in this funk of the evil is the camera itself. Which is an idea that's been around at least since 1960, but I'm not particularly fond of the Paranormal Activity series, for example. But between the found footage fetish that won't die, and the more sophisticated layering of footage within footage that we're getting in films like that one I actually liked. What was it with Ethan Hawke?
Sinister.
Yeah, I actually like that one. Yeah, Sinister.
Was it Sinister?
I think it was Sinister.
It was
Sinister.
The video, correct.
Yeah, Sinister was about the monster that ended up coming out of the artwork, coming out of the video.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, there's a strong fetish with monsters coming out of art. Then of course we have the Babadook and et cetera. But I think we're not achieving real distinct monsters because we're still obsessed with the idea of the medium being the monster. And so we haven't found what comes after our zombie fetish yet. But then again, the zombie fetish isn't that old. Again, a lot of us are tired of it, but it's not that old. And some people are still coming up with some interesting ideas with it. Like I really like Peter Wilburn's Link's book, for example. So there's that. You know, the zombie was the figure of the new millennium. So people were saying for a while, just the millennium's getting on now. No, I don't think that horror is tired, and I actually don't think horror is exhaustible. I think horror comes and goes in waves. I don't think it has to be peaking all the time to prove that it's still alive. I think American horror is in real trouble. I think horror cinema has been much stronger in Canada, generally in Europe, in Korea, in Japan. I think it's a growing horror market in India. I think a lot of places are willing to test boundaries in ways that American horror has just been too scared to in recent years. I think the indies are so much stronger than what the mainstream is putting out that the mainstream is risking irrelevance. But that doesn't mean that cinema is failing. It just means that the American market might be failing to keep up.
And I agree with that. I'm glad that you brought up the Babadook, because that's a movie I recently saw, and if anything's going to be iconic, I'm really rooting for the Babadook to be iconic, such as the other characters that have come from the past, such as Krueger or Voorhees, Dracula, so on and so forth. I do agree that America is in a crunch for original good horror, especially in the mainstream. As you had said, a lot of the independent sources is where we're getting some of the original ideas. I recently saw Poltergeist, the remake. And
I haven't seen it yet.
I won't give any spoilers. I'll simply say don't go into it expecting it to outdo the original. It's not going to outdo the original at all. As a matter of fact, this one was very watered down. A lot of the scenes that the original elaborated on, this one just watered down. And it actually kind of moved in the formula that Disney might would have for Pirates of the Caribbean or something like that. It was that very watered down formula. And pretty much, I enjoyed the concept of it. I enjoyed some of the new ideas that it introduced. So, therefore, it was an enjoyable experience. Did it scare me? Did it scare anyone in the audience? Everyone walked out of there saying, oh, well, that was something. And, I mean, no one was really excited about it. But at the same time, it grossed in all of this money on the opening weekend. And had it not been labeled as Poltergeist, and it been a reimagining of that, I don't think that it would have made half as much money as what it did.
Right. Right. Well, it's the magic of the pre-sold property.
Exactly.
You know, I'm generally a defender of remakes and the concept of remakes. You know, I think of remakes as a culture's way of embracing a story and trying to adapt it to reflect its current circumstances. But and so we shouldn't necessarily judge them by each other. But talk about a collaboration between Tobe Hooper and Steven Spielberg with a dynamite performance by Jo Beth Williams, give me my babies and all of her wonderful lines as she personifies domestic housewife turned ultra heroine. There's no way you're going to top that. You know, it sort of defined horror for the 80s and was one of the reasons that PG ceased to mean what it meant before because there's no way that movie should have been PG. It scared the heck out of me when I was a child. From the trailers, obviously they understand the clown was scary, but the clown was scary because it had no business being in a PG movie. The movie had a very cachet, not quite the Star Wars cachet, but it had this sort of sacred bubble of time around it for a certain generation, not to mention a sort of critical combination of talent that, you know, could never happen again. Spielberg would never, you know, produce a project like that again.
Exactly. And with the Poltergeist remake, yeah, I am saying go see it. Go enjoy it. Don't expect for it to outdo the original, though. And also in that aspect, if you can see it in 3D, I would suggest seeing it in 3D. But I would put it like this. If you're a parent and you have a kid who has never seen a horror movie, this one is so tame. I would be comfortable as an adult taking a child to that movie for it being their first horror experience. I think it would be perfect for that circumstance, actually. Now, going on to your next work of Dario Argento, I know that you've written a book about the great master Dario Argento, and I had asked quite a few questions about that last year. So for those who had listened to last year's interview, I don't want to hit the same questions again. So how about with this one, I simply just ask, what brought you into Argento, and do you still enjoy his movies today? And when I say today, I of course mean the current ones like Dracula 3D and so forth.
I've seen them all, and I'll get back to the enjoyment question in a moment. I'll give you a very literal answer. What got me into Argento? A guy named Dan. Dan Ingber. Went to college together. Weren't super close friends. We traveled in the same circles, and he kept telling me I had to watch movies directed by this guy whose name I could never remember. And finally, my first year of grad school, he came down to visit for some odd reason. And so he was in my neck of the woods, and we went and rented a movie, and we rented Argento's first movie, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, and I was so blown away by it. It was the first movie in years that I watched twice within 24 hours on a rental, and I realized I just had to watch more. And it was mainly for the main set piece, the scene of what we think is a woman being stabbed and sort of slowly crawling across the floor in this really bizarre art gallery, reaching toward glass while a man is trapped between panes of glass, and it's sort of surreal and just a visually astounding moment. And then of course I was to learn when I got to Suspiria and other films that it only got better from there. And I do still love them. I don't love his most recent stuff as much as what people tend to call his golden age, but I still enjoy it. I enjoyed Dracula. I liked it much more the second time, and frankly, much more after I talked to him about it.
Nice.
You know, he helped me understand what he was going for, and I was like, oh, okay. Cool. But I'm excited to see what he does with Hoffman's The Sandman, which is his current big project. And you know, if anybody could make a really classic weird story even weirder, I think that he's the man. So we should go for it.
Well, I tell you what, let me ask you this. Let's say you have a kid, a teenager, and today who wants to maybe try Argento because, you know, when I was in high school, I had heard all of these classic names that I had no idea who the hell they were until I just dove into it myself. And if you were advising a teenager today to try out an Argento movie, which one would you pick and why?
Now, we're saying kid as in 18, right?
15. We'll say, you know, mid-teens to late teens. I'm not going to lie. I started R-rated horror when I was like 8 years old. So I know.
So did I, but for various reasons, I would prefer to go on record making legal recommendations.
Okay, so we'll just say 18, or if they have a parent of with them.
Okay, yeah, I mean, if, like, with full parental permission, like, whatever, all of that assumed and in the fine print. So, you know, whatever is age appropriate according to parents or otherwise legal. There. To start with Argento, I mean, most people start at what is arguably the top, and that's Suspiria. That was your question, right? Where do you start with Argento?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it depends. I mean, a lot of people start there, and that's how they fall in love, and then they go and appreciate the other films. But then there's always the risk of, but wait, this isn't quite as mind blowing as Suspiria, and so there's that disappointment factor. So it's hard to know. Then again, some people love Deep Red more than Suspiria. Then there's my way of starting with his first film and then working your way toward his sort of, you know, triumph of films of the late 70s and early 80s. It's so hard
okay.
to decide.
Cool. All right.
But I think most people start with Suspiria, and then if they fall in love, they learn to appreciate his other visual flair and other films like Inferno, like Deep Red, like Tenebrae, like Phenomena, like Opera.
Oh, God, yeah. Love all of those movies. And with me, it's like when I introduce someone to Argento, it's kind of like a joke until they catch on. I'm like, oh, well, here's Suspiria. It's his masterpiece. And then we watch it, and I'm like, oh, here's Deep Red. It's his masterpiece. And then we watch it, and I'm like, hey, here's Opera. It's his masterpiece. And they're like, all right, well, you've already said that about his other movies. I'm like, yeah, he keeps just throwing them out. He keeps throwing them out. Yeah, they're all masterpieces.
Yeah, for a while there, he kind of didn't slip, and then
yeah.
he did a couple times. But yeah, he was truly amazing, and he still is truly amazing. He's just not he's more focused in what he cares about in each film, and so he allows other things to suffer. And I just don't think he cares.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really interesting, and I think he's still the Italian horror master as of today. Him and Fulci, those were two of my all-time favorites, and they probably will always be two of my all-time favorites. Now, moving on to other pieces of yours, Burning the Middle Ground. Just briefly, can you explain what inspired that book for you?
And talk about, you know, you're also got a sequel in progress, and yeah, I think you should comment a little bit about that too.
It was conceived as a trilogy at a time that I didn't really understand how publishing works, and so my idea of how long novels could be was, you know, came from Stephen King. And so I was thinking trilogy, but the third one's going to be really, really long. And now I'm thinking, well, gee, that might have to be multiple books. Maybe it's a quintilogy. But in any case, it was always conceived as a series. So Burning the Middle Ground, and it was always conceived that it was going to move in three phases anyway, where the first phase is basically this conspiracy getting started on a local level. The second phase is a conspiracy moving national. And the third phase is a conspiracy moving global. And so Burning the Middle Ground was phase one. So it's about a small town in Georgia, a fictional town called Kenning, and in the novel's present, it's 5 years before the novel's present, the beginning of what the reader encounters, a young girl murders her parents, and then in front of her 17-year-old brother murders herself. And he is left traumatized. And then in the present, 5 years later, for the traumatized now young man, a reporter comes down from New York to write the definitive book about the tragedy that befell this family. And he winds up embroiled in this struggle between the First Church of Kenning, Georgia, and this new church that's opening to challenge them, because basically there's this whole brouhaha surrounding the tragedy that's dividing the town along religious lines. And the preacher at the First Church is also starting to use supernatural powers to take over people's minds, and starting to, you know, dead bodies are showing up with their eyes ripped out, their tongues ripped out, and ritualistic murders and bad stuff is happening, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And so you end up with a small group of people who kind of figure out what's going on, and they have very little in common, while the rest of the town is being taken over by evil forces, and things don't really go very well from there. So that's the first book, and things are wrapped up. I even have one reviewer say, "Oh, it leaves a few weak openings for a sequel, but really, it's a standalone novel," which, fooled you. It's a suspenseful, you know, small town thriller, and I wrote it, so it seems like it stands alone. But you know, people just may not have noticed that there are characters who show up and get named and get described, and then just totally disappear from the narrative for no reason. Well, they're there for a reason, the entire book is just a tiny little piece in a much larger puzzle that the second book picks up on. The second book is called Manufacturing Miracles, and it is on a national scale. In fact, in what I've written so far, I've already pretty much destroyed one city entirely, there is. Some of the bad guys met and at least glimpsed in the first book are part of a much larger group who are related to my Fincherverse. The evil Dr. Fincher, who stands behind a lot of my fiction, wrote this book called The Alchemy of Will that basically ties all religions together into ritualistic formulae that produce all kinds of nasty things. These people have harnessed this to do we don't know quite what yet. I thought that this was going to be a sort of violence milder book than the last couple things that I've published. I was so wrong. what I've written so far is my life has been very stressful lately. The first scene, you know, I begin with buildings blowing up. I'm only about 10,000-15,000 words in. I've blown up a building. A city's been destroyed. Things are not going well in the United States right now. What people glimpse in the first book as far as what is possible in this world that I've created is really going really much, much bigger. You know, the body count in book one was like 40 or 50. It's already in the tens of thousands.
Oh, wow. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but your second book that in this series, the sequel to Burning the Middle Ground, that is Descending Lines, correct?
Descending Lines is set in the same universe, but it's okay. Not part of the series.
Okay. I was a little curious because as you were describing some of the ideas behind Burning the Middle Ground, I was noticing where it was matching up with the Descending Lines, such as the Alchemy of Will, so on and so forth, you know. And so that's what I was kind of curious.
The Alchemy of Will shows up in a lot of my writing. It also shows up in several of the short stories in Leaping at Thorns. Dr. Fincher has been around for me for a long time, and he's up to no good. Descending Lines is not part of the series. There are elements from Descending Lines that show up in other short stories, and again, what my friends and now some of my readers call the Fincherverse. And spoiler, there are things that are in Descending Lines that will show up in Manufacturing Miracles. But one doesn't have to have read Descending Lines to understand anything that's going to happen in the series.
Okay, so in a sense, it's kind of like what Stephen King did with the Dark Tower series. You have the Dark Tower series, but then you also have The Stand, and you have kind of like the alternate universes that kind of tie in together there. So that's how you connect yours, in a sense. Okay.
In a sense, I mean, you know, King did a lot of that after the fact. This has all been done in advance. I mean, I planned all this ahead of time. But yeah, all, you know, there's not all of my fiction relates. Like I have a mainstream thriller that I've written. Actually, no, that's connected too. Yeah, okay, I kind of tie everything together. So it's a lot like the Dark Tower.
Cool. That's awesome. I admire that.
Well, you mentioned the mainstream thriller, and I think there's a bit of interesting news that you have, which I hope we can break on the show tonight. Because I, can you speak a little to that with some of your latest news?
I have just signed with Justice Literary. I'm now represented by literary agent Alicia Justice, who I know represents some other guests you've had on the show who are friends of mine. And because she's done such amazing things for them, I'm hoping that she'll do amazing things for me. She signed me to represent me in general. She's interested in my range of work, but first and foremost, we're going to be working on a novel called The Blue Jacket Conspiracy that, unlike the novel we've been talking about, is actually finished. But it's a mainstream thriller, so a few horrific things happen in it, but it's not written for a horror specific audience. But is instead, but still in my conspiracy mode, and that it starts off as what seems like an office conflict based on tensions between an African American woman and a gay man in a sort of white collar office atmosphere in Atlanta, and they both sort of step on each other's toes, and it gets just worse and worse, and it snowballs from there to the point where they're ready to kill each other, but then there's there are hints that maybe what's going on between them is actually part of something that's much, much bigger that their company is up to, and so what seems to be this sort of, you know, racial and sexual feud is actually part of a much larger conspiracy that, of course, ends up, you know, involving national politics and everything is going to be perfect for an election year. That's my hope anyway. But it is a heck of a page turner. Most of my reading circle it's either their favorite or one of their favorite of my books. And though I've published, well, in terms of novels, I've published two. I've written about seven. So I'm very excited about its potential, and I think Alicia Justice is quite talented, so I hope we're going places.
Awesome. We're about to reach our 10-minute mark, and I want to be sure that we touch a little bit on Leaping at Thorns and also Real Dark. Could we perhaps learn a little bit more about those titles before we have to jump into asking about your links and how people can find you? Could we learn a little bit about those?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've already referred to Leaping at Thorns. Leaping at Thorns is a collection of short fiction. And what's kind of special about it is that it kind of spans my entire adult life, at least until it was published last year, in that almost all of the stories in the book are stories that I wrote on Halloween Day. I have this ritual where every Halloween since I was about 16 years old, I write a short story. And so there are a couple stories in there that weren't written on Halloween, but I finally decided that I had enough good ones that I should publish them. So none of them had ever been published before. And so I took them and of course I edited them and I arranged them into a triptych of themes, complicity, entrapment, and conspiracy. All of the conspiracy stories are directly related to that Fincherverse I was talking about before. So you get the very first Dr. Fincher story, The Fate of Dr. Fincher, in which he appears sort of, and I actually introduced the concept of the alchemy of will in his writing and his death at Harvard circa 1900, and take you through some of his evil influence in the 1950s and other periods of history. But also there's probably the most horrific thing I've written is the first short story in the book, a story called Charlie Murin and His Mother. And there's one short story that I actually read with for an audience that had children in it, and the children weren't traumatized. A sort of almost traditional ghost story, so it's pretty diverse.
Nice.
And it's gotten some acclaim, too, I might add. You've gotten some nice attention from such notable places such as Rue Morgue and also Dark Discoveries, correct?
Yeah, they were both kind enough to interview me and attach those interviews to some pretty nice reviews. So also many fellow authors have given me some kind blurbs, including some of those who published with you at Seventh Star. So I'm very grateful for that. So I hope that readers are enjoying, or at least being appropriately disgusted and challenged by the stories. They are surreal and extreme for the most part.
Very cool. Very cool. And we also have another near complete collection coming soon, I assume. Do you want to talk a little bit, mention about that real quick?
Yeah. I haven't pitched it to anybody, but because I haven't put it together yet. But I've been so prolific lately that I've got a collection that I'm calling. A nurse says I'm supposed to pronounce it peritoneum, though in AP Bio it was peritoneum. But peritoneum, which is a name for basically the sac that holds our guts together. But a couple of the stories are going to be in anthologies, and one of them is in the anthology, Real Dark. My short story in there is called Lear Real. Another one's going to be in the anthology, Missing Pieces 6, that's going to debut at Gen Con, and that story is called DNA. I've been writing just a lot of visceral stories. For example, in DNA, there's a guy trapped in a giant aquarium who discovers another guy who is very much the same shape of a soccer ball, and he contains no bones. And then he meets his counterpart, who consists of everything the other guy is missing. And so I've just been doing a lot of writing that involves very weird variations on the human body, not to mention flying tongues and tentacles and DNA and all just very, very, very visceral and surreal stuff. And also stuff that ties into the Fincherverse in ways that cross through history. I've been writing in the 1970s. I've been writing in the 80s. I've been going back into the 40s. I've been going into the 20s, and just generating this narrative that in some ways makes no rational sense because it's so surreal, but in other ways covers the entire history of the 20th century in fragments. So I'm excited about that too.
Nice. Well, where can everybody find you? I understand that you have some blogs and you have Facebook and all kind of really cool ways that people can interact with you. So what's some of the ways that people can hunt you down?
Easiest to remember is probably www.landrewcooper.com or facebook.com/LAndrewCooper. or amazon.com/author/LAndrewCooper. So there's a lot of consistency there. My Twitter handle, I'm actually not much of a tweeter, but my Twitter handle is LAndrew42. So you know that there's a part of me that's a Douglas Adams fan. So LAndrew42 is my Twitter handle. But yeah, those are the main things. Instagram, I haven't wrapped my mind around yet, so I'm not really on that one.
Pretty much the key with Instagram is just have fun with it and post about your books every now and then. Other than that, just have fun.
All right, I will endeavor to do so. Oh, I've definitely been.
Honestly, I think that's the way to work any Twitter and social media. I mean, yeah, have fun and occasionally post about your books because that definitely works a lot better than the buy your book crowd.
take advantage of Werewolf Wednesdays and Throwback Thursdays and Freaky Fridays and all that stuff. So if you take advantage of every day of the week with those little trendy names, then you're pretty good.
Yeah, I can't keep track, but it's fun.
I'm not going to lie. I have it written down in a notebook so I can, you know, be like, oh, yeah, today's Monday. It is like Monster Monday or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, that's clever. I can do Excel. I can make a spreadsheet.
Every day, wake up. Click on the Excel Instagram sheet. Oh, today is Monday, Monster Monday. There we go. Well, is there anything that we did not touch on before we run out of time tonight that you would like to address?
Well, we started off with Real Dark. We didn't come back to it too much there. So, again, let me just tell you that, you know, since I only contributed one story to it, I even say in my editor's intro, you don't have to read my story to get the money's worth. I am so impressed by the authors we managed to get together for this book. And I say it as Pamela Turner and I put together. Definitely, listeners out there, check out Real Dark, Twisted Projections on the Flickering Page, all about movies screwing up the real world. And movies talk about that all the time, but fiction writers don't do it very much, so that's an excellent book for folks to check out. Otherwise, look me up on Facebook. I've spent my life studying horror. It's hard to be more of a horror nerd than I am. So I love meeting other horror nerds. So it's great chatting with you guys about a subject that I'm passionate about and that I think is actually important.
Well, thank you, and hopefully one night soon we can all kick back and enjoy beer together or whatever your poison is.
That sounds good to me.
All right, and is there any final advice that you would like to give new aspiring authors before we have to go tonight?
A lot of people think that you have to be publishing to be a writer. Don't believe that. You're a writer if you write. And as long as you keep writing, the ways to publish you're gonna find them.
Amen. Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because I say that to a lot of people. That, you know, they say, "Well, I'm an aspiring writer. I'm not published." Well, do you write? Yes. Okay, you're a writer. that's
exactly
what I always say too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, cause I had that complex too before I published. Am I a real writer or not? And now that I publish, it's like, no, I'm the same person I was before. I was a writer before. Well, I'm a writer now.
On that note, thank you very much for joining us. Yeah, we're about to run out of time here, but thank you for joining us, Andrew, and definitely want you back again for a third time sometime in the near future.
All right, well, thank you so much. It's great talking to you, and I look forward to seeing you and talking to you soon.
You got it. And good night, everybody. And next guest up is Jerry Benz of Karen Coyne Press, and that's going to be coming up in 2 weeks. Good night, everybody, and thanks, Alex.
Good night.
Good night, and thank you. Good night.